65%. Here are the numbers. 65 Kenosha, 64 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the day we welcome back into our studios Kaylin Palomares, who works for Racine County. And tell us once again that long, elaborate title that you have with Racine County.
I am the conservation planner for the Land and Water Conservation Department for Racine County.
And I hope they can fit all that on your office door. So it's great to have you back. And you have brought with you somebody who has connection to your former employer and a place where you still have many, many dear friends and lots of connection, namely Hawthorne Hollow. And today we are going to be talking specifically about one of the loveliest additions to Hawthorne Hollow in relatively recent in the relatively recent past, namely the Heide Observatory. And with us as well is Dr. William Parker, who is professor of physics at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and director of the Heide Observatory. And we're going to be talking about when that became part of Hawthorne Hollow, when and why and how, and some things that people can attend to enjoy this observatory. And we're also going to be talking about something that does not get discussed enough, namely light pollution, and how excessive light not only is a problem for those of us who are stargazers, but is also an issue about many inhabitants of the natural world. And it's something we need to be conscious of, and there are things that can be done about it. And so we'll explore all of that and more today. So, Kaylin Palomares, we welcome you back to the morning show, and Dr. William Parker, for the first time, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Good to have all of you here. So, I have a feeling, Kaylin, does your connection to the Heide Observatory go back farther than Professor Parker's?
No. William has been a part of the observatory for longer than I have even known about Hawthorne Hollow, basically.
Wow, okay.
So
he's who we go to for the long historical view,
sure,
then.
Sure.
Well, very good. So first of all, we welcome you again, Professor Parker. Maybe ahead of us talking about the Heide Observatory, tell us a little bit about you personally in terms of where you are from and maybe a word or two about what first enticed you into the world of physics.
All right. Well, I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and lived there till I was 9. When I was a child, Halley's Comet made its appearance, and that was one of the first astronomical events that I remember.
Do I remember that was about. Was that the mid-70s?
It was 1986.
Oh, my gosh. It's more recent than I thought. Okay.
Yes. I recall vividly a book that National Geographic produced called Our Universe, which, if I recall correctly, included some of the first full-color pictures of Uranus and Neptune that came from the Voyager 2 space probe. And those were some of the formative things that made me interested in astronomy. I didn't really know what physics was until I was a teenager. We moved to North Texas, Fort Worth, when I was 9 years old. And so the rest of my formative years were spent there. I was a double physics and astronomy major at the University of Texas at Austin as an undergraduate. The Astronomy Student Association there was very strong. I remember a lot of trips out to look at the stars. We had an observatory just west of Austin, and then we made one big trip out to West Texas to the McDonnell Observatory, which is was the premier kind of research observatory for astronomers there at the university. And excuse me. what else is relevant? I mean, in terms of physics, I decided to go into physics because in astronomy, a lot of things are not known with very high precision. You might know something is 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times, but not 10,000 or not one, right? So those are called orders of magnitude. And at the time, I wasn't super comfortable with that uncertainty. So I went into an area of physics called electronic structure, where we simulate material properties based on the interactions of electrons. And those kind of quantities are known to much higher precision than astronomical quantities. But I was really excited when I moved here to Kenosha to work at Parkside that we had this observatory nearby. It was founded in 2016, which was actually the year I arrived. But I didn't find out about it until 2017. And then I was invited to become the director in 2018 when the inaugural director stepped down.
Very good. Well, I appreciate learning all of that about you. I have a brother who lives in Salt Lake City, and I just visited him last summer. And he happens to live on kind of one of the tall hillsides that sort of surround Salt Lake City. And I can't think of a better place to be if one wants to be a stargazer. I mean, you just sort of have this heavenly vista above you. And so I can imagine how, as a youngster, you got excited by things in the sky, and how fun that this opportunity at Parkside ended up affording you this other opportunity to be part of the Heidi Observatory. So what can you tell us about what happened in 2016 in terms of what precipitated this the creation of this observatory at Hawthorne Hollow?
So I'll tell it as best I understand it. I was not involved in it.
Sure.
But so Dan Lyons, who was the first director of the observatory, he has a long connection with Hawthorne Hollow. He started working there as a teenager. And he was working with a local philanthropist named Charles Chuck Heidi, who was very enthusiastic about astronomy and also inspiring young people to get interested in nature and in space and in technology. And so the two of them worked together to design and install the observatory and as a place where people in our community can come and learn about space and learn about our place in the universe and feel inspired by that. And so that's basically how it came to be, I'd say.
Right. So you are the director of the Heidi Observatory. What are your responsibilities?
Well, making sure that the observatory fills its function, that we are bringing as many people in from the community to the observatory as we can. And, you know, the observatory, it does events, programs to just to bring people in casually. And then we also host field trips. I teach a class for Parkside that meets at the observatory in the fall. We just started this past Tuesday. And I also work with individual students. I've worked with high school and university students who are interested in astronomy to help them learn how to use the telescope, to take photographs with the telescope, and do other things to advance their knowledge of astronomy.
Mm-hmm. So if we walk inside the door of the observatory, what do we see inside of it? I mean, what exactly is inside the Heidi Observatory?
So when you walk in, the first thing you'll see after you duck, because we have a low entryway in our door.
Kaylin is smiling and nodding as though you've had some mishaps in that doorway.
There is a foam on the top to prevent people from smacking their head on it, because it has happened a lot. And like, I'm short and I still have to duck. So
wow.
Yeah.
That's a little door then. Okay.
And I suspect that I have probably hit my head more on the door than anyone else.
Probably.
So anyway, when you step in the door, you duck through, there's a large pillar with a, two telescopes, in fact, on top of a stand, an L-shaped stand that holds the two telescopes. And that's usually the kind of the first thing that people noticed. And then you look up and you see that it's a dome, and there's a shutter. So kind of a rectangular curved strip that retracts to let in light only from one direction. And then as you look around the dome, you'll see we have various informational posters related to space to encourage people to think about things and connect what they see in the telescope when they're not looking to, you know, a broader picture. Of course, we have a computer that controls the telescope. And then we recently, this year, we purchased a large TV that can do very dim lighting so that we can project photographs that we take as we're pointed at things, so people that aren't looking through the eyepiece of the telescope can see a form of what we're pointed at.
Ah. So you said there are two telescopes.
That's correct.
And can you explain sort of the difference between them or the purpose of having two?
Yeah. So there are two major designs of a telescope. One involves a mirror and the eyepiece, which is a lens, a piece of glass that's curved. And then another type of telescope involves two pieces of curved glass, two lenses. And the main telescope, the big one that we have, is the kind that uses the mirror and the eyepiece. And then the smaller one has the two lenses, the eyepiece lens and then the main lens. And the only reason that we are using that particular one, the smaller one, is because it has, what's the right way to put it? We attach the camera to that one so that we don't have to switch out the camera and the eyepiece so that people can actually look with their eye, because one of our major focuses is to get people to connect with, you know, their bodies to the nature around them. And the camera, it adds a level of disconnection. I mean, it's nice and we like it, but, you know, you can see photos online much nicer than what we can produce in our observatory.
Right. Well, I remember from my amateur stargazing days, as someone who'd actually owned a telescope for a while as a youngster, that, yeah, there were, like, if you looked in the Sears Roebuck catalog, there were two different kinds of telescopes you could, and I remember one you kind of looked at from straight on, and the other, like, you were looking down into the tube. I can't remember what there's a term for each of those kind of
there is, yes, the one that you look straight through, I guess, sort of like a, I imagine a pirate or a captain on a ship looking out, right? Those kinds. Those are called refractory telescopes. There's sometimes called Galilean because they're named after Galileo Galilei. He first designed a telescope, or at least put those two pieces of glass and pointed it up at the stars.
Yeah.
And then the one that you look kind of sideways into the tube is named after Isaac Newton. It's called a Newtonian telescope. Mm. And there, the light stream is kind of bounced off a flat mirror after it bounces off another mirror at the other end. So kind of the first mirrored telescope. So and the one that we have, the big one we have, actually is a different design where you have a hole in the mirror. So the mirror, it's curved, but then in the center of the mirror, there's another hole so that the light from the big mirror, it bounces off a second smaller mirror and then comes straight back down the tube into the hole.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Now, I remember the telescope that I owned, I think, had a magnifying power of 150. And I remember that was towards the top, but I remember you could buy telescopes that were maybe 200x. I mean, I'm just curious, the telescopes at Heidi Observatory, I mean, is that something that is specifically calculated, the magnifying power of these telescopes?
So the magnifying power is set by two properties of the telescope. One is that big mirror, or if it's one of the ones with a big lens, the big lens. And then the smaller lens, which is the eyepiece, is the other factor. So you can change out the eyepiece, and we have a large set of those. It turns out the magnifying power that we have isn't much different from what you just described, like 100 to maybe 200 or 300. The major difference that you'll find with a larger telescope is its light gathering power. So I often tell people, like, when they're comparing what they see through the telescope to what they see with their eye, they'll say, why can't I see that with my eye when I look in the same spot? And it's because your pupil is so much smaller than our telescope, right? The telescope can bring in, we have a 17-inch wide telescope, so it brings in a lot more light than your pupil can bring in from that same point in the sky.
Right, and so you're going to see things through the telescope that you simply can't see
That's right.
with the naked eye. The other thing that is intriguing is the whole matter of how much you're magnifying, then how much are you seeing in this, and like how hard is it to find things in the sky? Like if you're looking for something very, very specifically, I should think that sometimes the level of magnification makes a difference in terms of just trying to locate something really specifically. Or are there other means by which you can locate something really specific that you want to
see? Well, that's a very interesting question, because that technology has evolved, even in my lifetime. It used to be, yes, you had to find, you would do some sort of star hopping where you would go from a brighter star to a dimmer star to a dimmer star until you find the thing that you're looking for using some map.
Sure.
Now we use computers to do it, and it's so much nicer. We upgraded our telescope just 2 years ago, and it now you just point and click, really, unless the object's not in your catalog, and then you have to type in its coordinates. But even then, it's so much better than finding things by hand. And because you're right, if you're the higher your magnification, the harder it is to make sure you're pointed at the right thing.
Right.
And even now, when we're looking at the very dimmest objects, it can still be quite challenging to understand what you're seeing. The most common thing that we like to show people is the planet, dwarf planet Pluto. It's very dim. And when we point at it, it's hard to tell if you're looking at something different from just a really dim star. And so, yeah, that is a real issue that you bring. But the computer programming has made it so nice.
Yeah,
it's a lot easier than it used to be.
I'm also curious about what the difference would be if we had these two telescopes, but not the dome, not the structure. If you were just in the middle of the big sort of front, not yard, but you know what I mean, of Hawthorne Hollow, without that structure, what would you lose? I mean, or maybe another way is, what do you gain by having those telescopes within that dome with just that relatively small opening?
There's two things you gain. One is the reduced light. So as I'm sure we'll talk about later, there is light pollution in our area. It's you just want to gather light from the thing you're pointed at and reduce the amount of ambient light that's coming in. It actually becomes even more acute when you're taking photographs, because you're exposing the camera for longer than, you know, your eye resets every few seconds, less than a few seconds. But so the light control is one issue that the dome gives you. The other is actually wind protection. So you don't want the telescope to shake while you're looking at it, because the tiniest shake will move it off the object that you're looking at. So the structure of the building, but also the dome, give us wind protection, and
very
that's
good.
Significant.
Kaylin, I'm curious about the rest of you. I mean, you once worked at Hawthorne Hollow and worked there for some time. What connection did you have with the Heidi Observatory?
A lot, actually. So when I was there, I did the education, and so I worked a lot with William and with Chad, who's the observatory manager there, with the field trips. And I would a lot of times be the main contact for people that wanted to go on field trips, and they'd say, I want to do a day sky program. So I'd shove them off to them because they're I don't know. My background is not in, you know, astronomy, so I couldn't even begin to teach a field trip on the day sky. But
right.
On top of that, I also did, I was kind of a contractor for the observatory. I worked outside of Hawthorne Hollow normal hours. I was working for the observatory, helping them with their social media and kind of events. I was going to every single event during that period. So I'm very close with them in a way that I just love the observatory, and I love these guys, and I love doing those events. I think they're important for people, but again, like, my background is not in that. So the extent of it is just kind of a love for it and not really a knowledge on any
of
this.
Yeah, understood. No, that's great. And I just want to add on a personal note that I knew Charles and Catherine Heidi pretty darn well. And so I mean, they've left an impressive legacy behind them in a lot of different ways. But of course, this is one of the loveliest, the fact that this is there and it bears their name. And it's an important part of all that Hawthorne Hollow offers to the community. For those of you just joining us, today is Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the morning show. And she has brought with her Dr. William Parker, who is a professor of physics at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and also director of the Heide Observatory, which is located on the grounds of Hawthorne Hollow. In fact, as you drive onto the property, it's right there. You cannot miss it. It's front and center. And we've been talking about all that people can experience when they visit the Heide Observatory. Tell us more, Dr. Parker, about the kind of things that go on there. I mean, and the sorts of things that people can experience.
Sure. I'll start with what Caitlin just mentioned, which is our daytime field trip, where we teach visitors about what things you see in the day in the sky that and how you can connect those to your life. So the sun travels from, you know, where it rises in the east and sets in the west. The moon is sometimes visible during the day. And we also have a solar system model that's scaled to the actual distances that the planets are separated from the sun on our meadow. And so we take people through that. If you come and visit Hawthorne Hollow during the day, you can even just walk it yourself. You don't have to be guided, but we have a guided tour of it. We have a sundial where you, as the human, cast the shadow that tells the time of day. And we also now have some signage that Caitlin helped us get a grant for. There's a sign on the observatory that describes a few things that you can see either at night or during the day there. But then we also have a sign that teaches you how the motions of the sun and the moon connect to our calendar and our ways of tracking time. Hmm. Of course, at night we have regular programming where we do a combination of show people things through the telescope, but we also have zero gravity chairs that we don't call them that, but that's what they're advertised as, where you can lie back and we point at things in the sky with our laser pointers, which are often stealing the show with the young people. they want to point the lasers and not look at the stars. But so we teach people to observe the sky directly. And then, of course, we have special events for various occasions. You know, when there's a lunar eclipse, that's usually we wait for the total lunar eclipses. Those come once every year or two. We had, of course, a big event for even the partial total solar eclipse, which we had a couple hundred people come out for. And again, there you're just looking through filters at the sun. But we have a lot of educational material. We try to teach people, you know, like things to look for that you might not normally just notice, or if you notice, you wouldn't know how to interpret them. What other events do we have? Well, as I mentioned, I teach a Parkside class there during the fall, and we meet outside as long as it's not raining or snowing. And part of that class, of course, is to teach the students how to connect what they see in the night sky with, you know, concepts that they learn. And that class is also has a cultural component where the students study a Native American culture and their understanding of the night sky or the way they conceptualized it. I don't know, Caitlin, am I missing anything that
the
you can
think of?
The meteor
showers.
Oh, the meteor showers.
Those are my favorites.
Yes. There's four major meteor showers during the year. There are lots of minor meteor showers. And so if we always schedule an event for one of these four, and then if it's cloudy, of course, we can't do anything. Though I'm always surprised when people are like, you know, it's raining outside and we get emails, is the meteor shower event on? I'm like, well, during a meteor shower event, you're lying on, you know, your back in one of our chairs, or we also let people bring their own blankets and chairs and just looking up at the sky for an hour or two. And meteor showers are not like rain showers. You don't get constant, you know, shooting stars going by. It's about, at best, one every minute or two. That's like the best kind of meteor shower. And then on sparser meteor showers, it can be, you know, a good 10, 15 minutes before you see one. So
some patience.
It is. And then it's just helping people develop expectations for what they're going to experience.
But when they go by and everyone sees the same one, everyone cheers. It's so it warms my heart when everyone gets to see it. Because sometimes one person will see one and, I just looked away. When everyone gets to see it, it's special. And I love those so much.
Yeah, it's like nature's fireworks, but a lot quieter. And it's also something completely out of our control. I mean, we are just observers of something that that is being...
Happens with or without us.
Yes, absolutely. Tell us about the Gala Under the Stars on Saturday, September 28th.
Sure. So this is our annual... it's a fundraising event where we celebrate, you know, the people who have donated to our, make our observatory keep running. Obviously, you know, Charles and Catherine Heide set us going for our you know, main functioning, but we still need funds to keep the lights on, keep the events happening. And so we have food and drink, and I usually give a brief report on what's gone on at the observatory, and then we try to, you know, let the people that come look through the telescope, and we show them things in the stars. And this year we're going to try adding some activities. That one thing I failed to mention is that we run a space camp for children during the summer, and so we're hoping this year at the gala to include some of those activities to let the adults experience what the children experienced. We shot off rockets, and we learned about, you know, gravity, and had all sorts of fun and little experiments, I think. So
that's fun.
Yeah, we're looking I'm looking forward to seeing how our donors will like those kinds of things.
Sure. I'm noticing on your calendar in early November on a Friday night, the Moon and Gas Giants. So this is something in which apparently people come and they get to see, you know, four of the most distinctive of the planets, of course, in order of closeness to us, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune.
That's
is that right?
Right?
Thank
That's
you.
Right.
And I can remember again, you know, as a youngster, how thrilling it was the first time I saw Saturn through a telescope. And you know, it's just one of those things you're not even prepared for, even after seeing, you know, hundreds of pictures in a book.
Yeah.
It's not the same. So I should think that's an especially exciting night.
It is. Yeah. And that feeling that you described of seeing Saturn for the first time, it's fun to kind of feel that vicariously when you observe other people. You know, sometimes people say, is there a sticker on the telescope? You know, like, it just looks so unreal.
It's so perfect.
Yeah.
It just looks so perfect.
Right. Like, it's almost like they put a decal right. on the lens. Right. No, that's the real thing. And then explain these things called Wednesdays Under the Stars. I mean, how sort of closely proctored are those? Is it essentially the same thing happening Wednesday night after Wednesday night, or does that tend to vary according to kind of what's going on?
It certainly varies depending on the interest level of the group. Mm. So the advertised focus of that event is lying back and looking up at the stars, you know, and we're happy to, you know, just point to things and say, you know, these are the constellations and here's bright stars, and this is how you find the planets, and we'll tell you stories about various constellations mm-hmm. and stars that people have told. That's the focus of that night, but then we usually do open the dome and show people things through the telescope, depending on the amount of interest. Sometimes people just want to lie back, you know, and enjoy whatever beverage they brought and just chat with each other and chat with us. But sometimes people are like, oh, I do want to see, look through the telescope. You know, those events are small. They're not more than 10 people usually, so we can really customize them to the interest of the group.
Right. That's great. You know, it's interesting as you're describing all of this, I remember that because I had a real interest in this kind of astronomy as a young person, it's one of the things I really thought about exploring. And one of the reasons was that our next-door neighbor had an amazing telescope. And she subscribed to Sky and Telescope magazine, and I would come over when she was going out. She would invite me to come over, and she called me her laboratory assistant. I mostly just like held the table, you know, steady. But I was really contemplated exploring astronomy, maybe as one of my majors in college, and then I learned what it was, and it did not interest me anymore because it wasn't just, you know, which is the biggest planet and which planet has the most moons and what makes craters and, you know, that kind of, and constellations and the 15 first magnitude stars. It was all this other stuff that did not seem as sort of tangible. And so I really turned away and never seriously contemplated it. What you're describing is all this sort of ground level astronomy stuff. And I should think for you as someone who teaches this and teaches the wide range of what astronomy is, it must be kind of fun that some of what you get to do kind of takes you back to there's Saturn, you know, and yeah. there's the red spot on Jupiter and so on. I mean, on that sort of most basic sort of gateway level that people are often interested in this.
It certainly does. I mean, that's a large part of my motivation for being involved is that I love that emotional experience that people get when they realize like things that they've heard about or are actually there that they can connect to them by just looking at the right place. And having that sense of where you are in the universe. And I think the vastness of the universe, you know, you can kind of experience just by looking up at the night sky and seeing all the stars, or as many as you can see from where you're at. But there is a level at which I think you do have to go a little bit past just looking, right? To know, you know, people have looked up forever, and they've come up with different stories. And the imagination of humans, I think, has never been as amazing as what actually is. Like when you learn how to understand distances in space, that's when it really becomes overwhelming, almost how vast the universe is. Like I can tell you a number, but if you don't understand how that number, like what context it has, like how did we come up with that? It's not as impressive, I think. So there is a level at which, you know, there's the direct experience of the stars is amazing, and it's great, and I love connecting people with that. But I do also like the next level of can we engage your mind and make those inferences that aren't like directly observable, like
sure.
to go beyond first level observation.
Sure, what's so. Readily apparent. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. For those of you just joining us, we are talking today on the morning show about the Heide Observatory on the grounds of Hawthorne Hollow, the former professional home and still very much emotional home of Kaylin Palomares, who has arranged this visit to the morning show by Dr. William Parker, who is a professor of physics at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and director of the Heide Observatory. Kaylin, I know that one of the reasons why you wanted us to have this conversation today is not just to talk about all of the wonderful things one can experience at the Heide Observatory, but also to talk about this thing called light pollution, which, of course, is a bigger topic than even, you know, irritation and inconvenience for stargazers. It goes far beyond that. Tell us a little bit more about maybe when you first became even aware of this thing called light pollution and kind of where you think this discussion should go.
Well, it's not something that I think I was always aware of. I can remember as a kid, my family has a farmhouse up north outside of Eau Claire, and usually around Thanksgiving time, we would go up there for hunting season, and we would sit outside on a nice night, and it's just clear. The sky is pitch black, and the stars are, it looks like there's millions of them, right? And then coming back home, down here to Racine County, or, you know, and I'd look up, and I'm like, it doesn't look the same. And now, as I've gotten older, and then I've obviously worked with the observatory, on a personal level, we are trying to look for things, and there's just this sheen in the sky that we can't see anything from, you know, one side of the sky because there's a busy road over there, or that's where Milwaukee is, or that's where, you know, A, B, and C. You know, there's a lot of different things that cause the light pollution. But also, after being at Hawthorne Hollow, I learned the kind of ecological aspect of that as well. So there's so many nocturnal animals that live around here. Everyone loves their raccoons. No, they don't. They don't love them. But everyone knows of raccoons. Everyone thinks of, you know, maybe bats. But there's also insects that are nocturnal. There's moths. And these nocturnal animals, they get confused when there's light pollution. When there's light on 24/7, they think that's the moon or they think that's the sun. It confuses their schedule. It can also throw off migration patterns for some of these animals or even birds. So from an ecological standpoint, it disrupts a lot of things for these animals that have very specific schedules on which they live. So, but from a astronomical perspective, William will talk about it, but it's just a really big inconvenience, if nothing else. It's I don't know if you want to.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to add on, it also affects humans.
Yeah.
So many of our listeners will know that blue light late at night will disrupt the quality of your sleep, and that bright lights also affect, you know, your brain. And in the morning, that's great. We want blue light. We want bright light. It's what, you know, what we've evolved to get us started in the morning and help us be active for the day. But then at night, we don't want those things so that we can wind down and have a restful sleep cycle. Also, some people talk, another human issue is, you know, we like light at night so we feel safe moving around, right, so that we can see things. But the intensity and the color of light can affect our ability to see. So if you have a bright bluish light at night, you can definitely see right below that light. But beyond the scope of that light, you can't see. And if you've ever been driving at night and someone with bright bluish headlights comes your way, you know that all you can see is those headlights and nothing else. And I've noticed, I borrowed a car recently that had bright bluish white headlights, and it's true that the field of which the headlight shone was very well illuminated, but then immediately outside of that I couldn't see anything. So if there was a deer waiting to jump across the road, I wouldn't have been able to see it. Or if there was a human like just in the wrong spot, you know, you can't see that. So those bright lights, they make you feel good in the area that they're shining, but then you can't see outside of them. And I don't think the solution is we need to illuminate the entire, you know, neighborhood with bluish white lights, you know, because then, you know, all those animals that are out at night, they won't be able to, I mean, I don't know what happens exactly to their life cycles, but
it can't be good.
And I know that Kaylin has personally lived in a place that had bright blue lights out at night, and you know, you close your blinds and you put on your sleep mask and hope for the best, but
it was like daytime in the middle of the night with blinds down. It was crazy. I won't call them out, but yeah.
Yes. Wow. But it's not good for the humans to have these super bright night lights. And of course, the other thing that people might understand is, you know, the sky is blue, and the sky is blue because the sunlight gets scattered by our atmosphere, which we obviously need to breathe. But that also means that blue light particularly is what scatters in our atmosphere. So if you have a bluish light outside your house shining, it's not just going to illuminate the ground below it, but it's also going to scatter and produce this glow that Kaylin mentioned around the sky. And it will make it difficult to see, you know, anything else at night. So the answer isn't no night lights. The answer is lights that are warmer in their color, so towards yellow and red. If you come to the observatory, you'll see we have red lights, both in and outside the observatory. And that has the red light does not scatter, so it only illuminates what's below it. But also there's an effect on our eyes. Blue light makes our pupils contract so that, you know, less light gets in there, and red light allows our pupils to relax and dilate and allow more light in, which at night is what you want. You want to get more light into your eyes so you can see things.
Yeah.
In fact, it takes, there's kind of two stages of night, of dark adaptation for your eyes. One takes about 15 minutes, and then there's another stage that takes about an hour. So it's also a struggle we have at the observatories getting people not to shine their beams from their car when they drive in, you know, because if we've been there for 15 minutes, our eyes have adapted, but then suddenly you get a flash of that bright light and your pupils contract again, and then like, okay, now we have to wait.
And also their cell phones and their flashlights on their phones.
Yes, and all those things.
Fascinating.
So
it sounds like we have not made wise choices when it comes to first of all, the amount of light we're creating and the kind of light we're creating, where we're putting our lights, where we're pointing our lights. I mean, there are a whole lot of different things. And I suppose once upon a time, nobody was even thinking about something called light pollution. And of course, now we are. And now it's a matter of trying to undo some things that have been done.
Right. Yeah. There's always this infrastructure question, right? Because you know, we want lighting, and we want to make things better. Like, it used to be a big push was we just need to cover light so they don't scatter light upward and sideways. They illuminate what's below them, what they're intended to illuminate. Now there's been a big shift towards LED lights at night, which there's no problem specifically with LEDs, but they tend to be bluish white.
I was just going to say, as when I think about LED, that's almost always what I think of, and I wondered if that is a necessity.
It's not. No, there okay. You can get LED lights that are red, that are yellow. You can get LED lights that can, you know, shift between colors. So it's purely it's a combination of manufacturer choice and then just the kind of the, I would say the surface level thing that, oh, brighter is better, right? Or the blue light definitely produces a sharper image, right, where you're looking at the light, but then it blinds you outside of the region that the light illuminates.
Right.
So teaching people that you know, you can get non-blue LED lights, and so you get the energy savings and the longer lifetime. But then also, you know, you cover the light appropriately. You know, you illuminate what needs to be illuminated, and don't blind people at night.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So I suppose part of this is the choices that individual private citizens make. But I should think that's relatively limited. It's even more important that. I mean, the town of Summers or the town of Sturtevant or the city of Racine or the city of Kenosha, the choices that they make, I should think, matter a whole lot more.
It definitely is. Our municipalities probably have the biggest influence on our lighting. In fact, I would say, just anecdotally in our region, the large private industries are very good about their lighting because there are standards of illumination. This is not – people have been – understanding this for decades. This is not a new situation. There are standards of how to properly illuminate at night, and if you go look at some of our local industries, the larger ones, their buildings are well illuminated. The lights are covered. They're not the bluish lights. They're yellowish looking.
So when you say they're well illuminated, you also mean they're like wisely illuminated.
They're wisely illuminated, yeah. Right? Yeah. Whereas some of our municipalities have installed on the street lights these bright bluish lights. And what I mean, at our observatory in specific, we can see there's a road. I won't point out which road it is, but there's a road that is super illuminated, and it destroyed our vision in that direction at the observatory.
It's an excessive amount of lights, too. Mm. It's not even just that they're the blue colored LEDs, there's also a million of them.
Mm. And I believe they're not well covered.
No.
So, interesting.
It's all the factors went wrong in that design.
Interesting. And of course, I suppose, you know, this is the kind of thing where concerned citizens can do some lobbying or pick up the telephone or whatever, but try to get something like that potentially changed.
Right. And it's just a matter, again, of being aware of the right choices you can make. They're not more expensive choices. They're just, you know, get the right kind of lighting, and you don't even have to, like, immediately get rid of all the bad lights, even if we might fantasize about doing that. You can just start, as you install new lights, start installing the correct kinds of lighting.
It's a fascinating field, and it's of course, so interesting to think about something that we should have been thinking about but weren't thinking
right.
about, and we need to get some of this entrenched outmoded
yeah.
thinking out of the way. And of course that's, it sounds like that's one of the things even at the Heidi Observatory you're trying to do.
We are. We in as part of our Earth Day celebrations this year, in fact, we had a astronomy program specifically devoted to this topic called Dark Skies on Earth, where we tried to create a number of various interactive activities that people could experience the differences in different kinds of lighting. How it affects us as humans, how it affects wildlife, and how it affects our viewing of the night sky.
I remember, was it earlier this year that we had a fairly unique look at the Aurora Borealis here in southeastern Wisconsin? I can't remember when that was, but...
There was just an instance, like, not even a month ago.
That's right.
That we saw it.
So
that was during the meteor shower, correct?
Yeah.
No.
Yes, it was, in fact, because our colleague Chad, who's the managing director of the observatory, he was out there looking for meteors, And he didn't see very many meteors in this particular meteor shower this year, but he did see the Aurora Borealis.
I was there too.
Right. Yeah.
You were there.
But I always find that, you know, when you're looking for that, that's when you especially regret light pollution, because sometimes what you're looking for is very, very subtle. You're not used to it being there. It's not like Jupiter. Yeah. And it's like, what am I seeing here? Am I just seeing reflections off the nearby Burger King, or is this what I think it might be? And yeah, for all kinds of different reasons, we need to make wiser and better choices about the way in which we illuminate the world. And I appreciate you making the case for that. Let's remind everybody of this next big event at the Heidi Observatory, of a fundraiser called Gala Under the Stars on Saturday evening, September 28th. Looks like 6 to 9 p.m. with all kinds of wonderful things going on. And it looks like if you go to Hawthorne Hollow's website, you can reserve your tickets for that event. And I imagine you're going to be there helping to serve the cookies and welcome the guests, right?
We'll have even better food than cookies.
All right. Very good.
I'll be there, too.
Oh, okay. Very good. Dr. William Parker, it's great to make your acquaintance today. Thank you so much. And
best
wishing with your teaching and all that you do with the Heidi Observatory as well. And Kaylin, before we go, I think you have a couple things you want to tell people about.
Yeah, well, we kind of covered some of them just now. So I had the Gala Under the Stars, and then I also had just the general observatory events that are kind of nightly, depending on cloud cover. Again, that can all be found on hawthornhollow.org. There's an observatory tab on there where you can see specifically observatory events. But also, I need to throw in, about 2 months ago on the show, I had Dr. Jim Studi, who was a part of the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. There is a field day going on today, Thursday, from 9 to 1:30 at Caseygo Park in Rochester. And that field day we have a bunch of awesome speakers coming in. We are going to be doing some just conversations about soil health and about pest management on a, ecological scale. Pest management and how to deal with the ecology of a farm and of your soil. We're talking about, there's a test plot out there, a research plot, which Jim talked about.
Yes,
so
right.
We'll be actually seeing that, and Jim will be talking about his research on that plot and about cover crops. So it's going to be a good time. There's free lunch. Obviously, that's a good pull to get you out there. So that's coming up here soon. So if you're driving right now, turn around and go to Caseygo Park.
Head over to Rochester.
And I will be there.
Very good. Kaylin Parlmaris, thank you for arranging today's very interesting program. And we'll look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Thanks, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you're going to be hearing my interview with the author of a brand new book called The Price. The book is a look at the current state of college football, that is, college football with big colleges and universities, and the way in which enormous amounts of money have utterly changed the game and the relationship between student-athletes and the game of college football. And from the archives, an interesting conversation about one of the greatest NFL quarterbacks of all time, Tom Brady. This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show on Saturday, the co-authors, husband and wife, of a book called Happy Together. And on Sunday, hearkening back to 9/11, which of course, the anniversary which we just passed, a memorable conversation about New York City firefighters with best-selling author Tom Downey. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and it's available 7 days a week as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be sunny and quite warm for this time of year, a high temperature of 86 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 63. Tomorrow, Friday, a little more comfortable, partly cloudy and a high of just 78 degrees. Saturday, sunny and a high of 80, a some chance of rain on Sunday, and temperatures will remain quite comfortable as we enter the beginning of next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.